Hello, everybody. Welcome to the season one finale of Where You From. Thank you so much for joining me in my conversations with Ben Stiller, Michael Arsenault, Christina Hutchinson, Jonathan Colton, Adam Pally, Jenny Yang, and now my season finale guest, actor Thomas Sadowski. Tommy is just a great person. He's an awesome human being. He's very active with different charities, including the organization War Child, which you should really check out online if you are at all interested in helping with the refugee crisis and with education for kids around the globe. He's also an actor. He was Don Kiefer on The Newsroom. He is on Life in Pieces. He's been in a bunch of stuff. He's done a ton of theater because he's a total theater nerd from College Station, Texas, although he was born in Connecticut and lived there until he was 5 years old. I have noticed one particular common thread throughout this first season of Where You're From, and it is this: where you're from inevitably affects who you become, whether you love where you grew up, as Jonathan Colton did, and as Ben Stiller did, and as Christina Hutchinson did, and as I think Michael Arsenault did, where you're kind of like, yeah, it's fine about it, as Adam Pally seemed to say in his episode. If you absolutely adore it and you're the queen of your high school, like Jenny Yang was, I think, or you really fucking didn't like it, as you'll hear Tommy describe. Inevitably, who you become is in some ways a reaction to where you were raised and the people who raised you and the culture that raised you and the subcultures that you ran into. So suffice to say, I have had an awesome time this first season, and I really loved talking to Tommy. He's so thoughtful. He's such a brilliant human being, and I think you're going to love him. So here we go. Everybody, I'm so excited to sit down with my friend Tommy Sadowski to talk about where he's from. Hi.
Hi, friend.
Hi, friend. How are you?
I'm doing all right today.
So you are an interesting case study in where you're from.
That's what I hear.
That's the best way to intro anybody. You're an interesting specimen, Thomas.
Thank you. Indeed.
Let's talk about that.
I was once interviewed by a fashion magazine who told me that I looked good with clothes on. And I sort of felt like that's the equivalent of what you just said to me. You're an interesting case study in home.
Case study, yes. I was talking to a friend the other day who, well, we'll get into where you're from in a geographic sense in a second, but I think there's something very interesting that happens to actors who work a lot and who kind of tend to disappear into their roles a bit. Because I was talking to a friend the other day and talking about who I was interviewing for the podcast, and I said, oh, my friend Tommy Sadowski is doing it, and she like knew that you had played Dawn on The Newsroom.
Yeah.
And then I was talking about a different role that you've had. I was like, oh, yes, and he did this and he did this. And she was like insistent that that wasn't you. And it's so interesting because in none of these roles were you like wearing prosthetics or doing something differently. She was just kind of like, no, that's somebody else. I was like, no, it like you can look at his IMDb. Like he's played those different characters. But I felt like I wanted to share that with you because I feel that is a big compliment to you.
It's a tremendous compliment. I really appreciate that. I think that, you know, the best compliment I've ever gotten in terms of my work is somebody once said to me that I was an actor's actor. And like that meant more to me, I think, than anything that any compliment I've ever been given. And that what you just said sort of is the equivalent of that. I feel like, you know, people go like, no, that wasn't you.
Definitely you. She was just like, no, that was someone else. That also was good. But, you know, she didn't object to any of these roles. She liked all of the roles we were discussing. She just was very insistent that these were three different actors. And I was like, but these were all within what? And I then I realized, oh, this is a really cool sort of kudos to the work that you do.
That's very nice. Thank you.
Do you find that when people see you that they call you by your character's names from whatever they know you from?
It's interesting. I get that a lot with The Newsroom. People will, you know, see me or will see that I'm married to Amanda and say, oh my God, Amanda's married to Don Kiefer. I was walking down the street.
Yes, she is. Yeah,
that's why she married me. I was walking down the street in New York a few years back, and actually was walking along, and some guy was passing by me and pointed at me and yelled, "Don Kiefer." But he didn't stop, which is like the most New York thing ever. He just yelled Don Kiefer into my face and then just kept walking. And I sort of just kept walking also. And I was like, all right, yeah, that's New York for you. But yeah, you know, I get a lot of that sort of like, hey, Don, or you're Matt from Life in Pieces. And I'm like, yeah.
I was talking to, not for this podcast, but I was interviewing for a different thing that by the time this comes out may or may not be published, so I won't say what venue it is, but I was interviewing Jason Mantzoukas, and he was saying how people I was thinking about the idea that people sometimes know an actor based on where, like, the piece of work that you did that most affected them, that's who you are to them.
Yeah.
So to some people, they think that he is his, you know, that he's Rafi. Or for some people, they think he's his character on The Good Place. And right. And that's, you become kind of frozen in their mind as that thing.
Sure. I mean, you know, I look at people who have become abundantly successful, who are really tremendous talents, like David Schwimmer pops to mind. I think David is actually a profoundly underappreciated talent. He's a great director. He's a great theater director.
And he was heartbreaking in as I felt as Robert Kardashian.
Yeah.
Like, just the amount of sort of, you could see over the course of the of his portrayal, like, how crestfallen he becomes as the character realizes that that he's surrounded by people who have been in some way lying to him.
Yeah.
As he has profited off it in some ways.
And, you know, he has that, there's an incredible humanity that burns inside of David that I think comes out very easily, you know, and I think that people relate to him, which is part of the reason why everybody loved him so much is Ross Geller.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, getting people to shake off Ross Geller.
That's hard, right?
It's a very hard thing.
It's
you know,
curse of that kind of success.
It is, you know, and I think that's one of the things that I'm so blown away by my wife is that she has played so many of these iconic parts. Like when you think of Amanda Seyfried, you think of Mean Girls, you think of Karen Smith, you know, but you also think, oh my God, Sophie from Mamma Mia.
She's one of the most like gift people, like her react, because her reactions are so precise and powerful in her work and so fucking funny.
Yeah.
Sometimes when they're supposed to be funny.
Yep.
That like people will just use. I think that's interesting to have your face used to underscore someone's 140 character sentiment.
Yeah.
Because you just did such a good job of hitting that particular moment.
Expressing a period of a moment of humanity. No, it is. It's an extraordinary thing. Yeah. And like when you're able to succeed at it a lot in various different ways, what you manage to do, I mean, you have people who hold on to you for various different reasons and you are forever this person to this person or this person to this person. And I think there's something really beautiful about that. I think there's also something really scary about it.
Yeah. I think about the kind of ownership that people feel, over future success if they get to know you as one thing in their mind, right?
Right.
They get to know you as one thing. And I've seen this with authors of whom I've been a fan. I lock into one book that meant so much to me. And sometimes you want, for some reason, even though as an artist, I don't like this, but I know I've projected this onto others, you want them to just be that thing. And sometimes they stretch and grow creatively.
One hopes.
Yeah, you would hope that they do different things and that they're not just that thing forever.
Right.
When you were growing up, did you know from the start that you wanted to be an actor?
No. No, I wanted to be a dolphin trainer.
What? That's awesome.
Yeah.
Like a SeaWorld dolphin trainer?
Yeah, but this is long before Blackfish. So
right,
like
so you didn't know.
Understood. I was a kid. You know, all I knew is that they were dolphins and that these people got to hang out with them all day and like communicate with them and talk to them and feed them and play with them and swim with them. And learn about them, you know, and learn from them. And like, that's all that I knew. You know, I think that at that point I hadn't sort of put consequences together yet.
As a kid, it's just exciting to think about interspecies communication.
Yeah, that you can be understood so profoundly. I think that you know, it's kids and animals, man. You know, nothing will crack my heart open faster. And I think that is because there's just an immediacy and a purity of communication that you're getting there. And an ease that is, I don't know, it's unaffected. And I think that watching kids, particularly with kids with animals, and watching animals with kids is something that, a limitless amount of joy for me. So no, I wanted to be a dolphin trainer.
That's great.
And
that's so specific. Like so I ask, specific. I tend to ask this question in whatever kind of interviewing I'm doing, whether it's for magazines or for the web or for podcast heaven, which is what we're sitting in right now. But I always wonder if I'm interviewing somebody, like, did you know from the start what you wanted to be? And that's the most specific answer I've ever gotten, is dolphin trainer.
Dolphin trainer.
Yeah, I've never heard anybody else say that.
Didn't want to mess with the killer whales. Mm-mm. Had no interest in the seals or the sea lions. Dolphin trainer.
You liked a streamlined, bottlenose dolphin.
Yep.
Full of wisdom, possibly smarter than human beings sometimes.
Oh, no, I think undeniably smarter than human beings all the time. I think, you know, there's something that I realized as an actor that is a sort of a universal truth for me, which is that I have worked my entire career to get back to playing with the ease that I did as a child,
mm-hmm.
To acting with an engaged imagination, so specific and so unencumbered by ego. And criticism, self-criticism, as I did with a child. And I think that as human beings, the greatest achievement we will ever, ever have is to sort of get back to our pre-society selves when we were living in direct harmony as a part of nature rather than alongside of and certainly not domineering over nature. That will be our achievement when we are actually able to come back to living in order with the natural world around us. And I don't know that we'll ever achieve that. I think that the planet may get rid of us before then.
Yeah, the planet may fire us.
Yeah.
It's in the process. It's given us a lot of chances.
We've come into HR a couple times now.
We've been called on the carpet, and the violations are really egregious at
this point.
We're
not long from the pink slip now, my friend.
I wonder if, I'm not a parent, but I wonder if becoming a parent provides opportunities to see exactly what you're talking about. I would think that one of the most exciting, I mean, I was in, I was taking a flight yesterday from Charlotte, North Carolina, and there was this family there, this mom and dad and this kiddo who was about 11 months old who had just started to walk. And it was just such a fun thing. And I could tell that the parents were having fun too, to watch this baby toddle around and discover, looking at certain lights and looking at certain things and getting so excited about a particular breed of dog. It was like a Saint Bernard, I guess, like a big dog that the kid had clearly never seen before.
Sure.
And I would think that would be one of the joys of being a parent, along with all the hard stuff, obviously, is just seeing them start to wake up to the world around them so effortlessly.
Yeah, because it wakes you back up, you know? We sleep so deeply in this life. I think we do it out of protection, you know? I think as we grow up, it's part of the way that we protect ourselves. As we grow up and as we grow older and we start to understand the real pain of the world, and we start to see the things around us that are just so unpleasant and so scary and so heartbreaking, there's part of us that just naturally starts to turn off. And unfortunately, one of the first thing that goes when you turn off those parts of yourself is you start to lose that childhood wonder. You know, there's nothing more beautiful in the world than watching my daughter discover something new. She says, wow.
She does.
Oh, yeah. And she means it, you know? And she means it in a way that I haven't meant it in decades. And only until she came into my life have I actually started to say wow with any kind of real meaning anymore. And oh man, it is just absolutely breathtaking to be around a kid. You know, I look at things differently when I'm in her presence than I do when I'm not. She wakes me up.
Does she? I think that, I mean, I don't know Amanda, but I think that it seems clear from what she posts about and talks about online and in interviews that she's definitely a big fan of animals as well and loves animals.
Yeah, you could say that. Yeah.
And I'm wondering if your little bean sprout is that way as well, because it's you from being a tiny person clearly loved animals and connected with them.
Yeah.
And we can say like, oh, I'm an animal lover. It's a pretty typical thing to say. But it sounds like there was a specific kind of special thing that you've noticed and connected with. It seems that your wife has. And I'm wondering if this small person you live with also is the same way. If she notices creatures in that way.
She's fascinated by them. You know, she's absolutely fascinated by them. And it's one of the things that I fell in love with first about Amanda, and one of the things that I love the most about her is that there is a way in which Amanda has refused to give up a lot of that part of herself. She has refused to go to sleep in terms of so many things in this world. She's so inspired by so much, and she's so moved, and she's so touched and so moved by innocence and by other creatures, you know, in a way that is, I use this term as a compliment, childlike.
That's cool.
In its beauty and in its power. You know, that's not infantilizing her. I actually see that as an extraordinary gift that she has, and one that I'm so thrilled that my daughter gets to grow up learning from. So, yeah, I mean, watching our daughter, like, with Amanda, watching them discover, you know, creatures together, you know, either in the real world or on flashcards or whatever, you know, she's fascinated by them. She's obsessed with our dog. She's absolutely obsessed with our dog, you know. When they're out of town and we FaceTime, you know, I put the dog on FaceTime and she just starts giggling. She just giggles and giggles and giggles and Finny, 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 you know, and it's just the best.
Is your dog named Finny?
His name is Finn.
I have a nephew named Finn who is 14 months old now.
Oh.
And we FaceTime. And he thinks it's very funny if you do if you do a ponytail bop, like if you bop your head forward with a ponytail, he thinks that's so funny. Or if you pretend to sneeze.
Oh, wow.
That's like high level comedy arts.
Absolutely.
And that's so fun. I mean, even it's not the same as being a parent, but having a kiddo in your life when I don't think I grew up around. You know, it was me and my brother. So I didn't have a whole bunch of little kids around when I was growing up. And yeah. I love kids. Kids,
is
babies, and animals. Now
younger?
He's younger. He's 3 years younger, and I think now in my 30s, I've just really opened up and like love them so much. Did you come from a big family or?
I'm an only child.
Oh, okay,
but I come from a huge family.
Really?
So I was raised with you know, Polish Catholic.
Oh yeah, our people. Irish Italian Catholic over here. We like to make people.
Yes. We're very good at it. My father is one of eight.
Whoa.
And every single one of his brothers and sisters had multiples, I'm pretty sure. So, like, I had tons of cousins that I grew up with, you know, and this big, huge family of aunts and uncles, cousins, grandparents, you know, and the whole thing. And so in as much as I grew up an only child, I grew up with this big, huge family, this big, huge, beautiful family. And having kids around was a regular part of our deal. You know, like each generation sort of took care of the generation below them, particularly at the big, you know, get-togethers at Christmas and the big family get-togethers or whatever. You know, we sort of self-policed.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, which was, well, you know.
I mean, it's cool if the person over you is rad.
Right.
But if you have a tough older cousin who's being an asshole, that's hard.
And you know, largely we're a good lot. You know, we're pretty good. But And we had a lot of fun. I mean, you know, the cousins all love each other very much, which is really cool. We all get along. But
so you were, I mean, you were born in Connecticut, but then you were raised in Texas.
Yeah.
So it was a big Polish Catholic family, extended family in Texas?
No. No, they're all up in the East Coast. So I was born in New Haven and grew up outside of New Haven in a little town called Bethany.
Okay.
And then when I was 5 years old, 5 or 6 years old, we moved to a town called College Station in Texas, very far away from.
God, that's a schlep and culture shock.
Huge culture shock. One of my first memories of school in Texas in College Station was being introduced, like whatever we had to go around one of the first days of class and say like who we were, and my teacher, sort of asterisked me with, Tommy wasn't born here, so he's not a Texan.
That's hobbling you from the start.
I
that's
was
terrible.
I was right out of the gate. Right out of the gate, I knew that I wasn't ever going to fit in. I was not ever allowed to be a Texan. So I never took on. I never even pretended. I'm not a Texan. I wasn't born there. I lived there for 13 years. I have a lot of great memories of the place. I met a lot of extraordinary people. I had a childhood that was full of stories and starlight, you know, because that's the nature of growing up in the country in Texas. You know, you're part of a big sky storytelling culture where everything is, you know, slightly hyperbolic. And
it is beautiful. I have people in Houston and in Dallas and outside and out in the countryside in Texas is it's so huge. It's like if I say out in the countryside in Texas, it's like, okay, well, what part of Texas are you talking about?
Yeah, no.
It's vast. It's big. It is beautiful. But it is a place that in a weird way can be quite insular.
Oh, it is. It's deeply, deeply insular, you know, and particularly in the kind of town that College Station was when I was growing up in it, it was a town that didn't want to answer questions that you might have. It didn't want you to ask too many questions.
Mm.
It just wanted you to sort of go along with it. This is how we do things, you know. This is tradition. This is how it's always been done, and this is how you do it. And for somebody like me, who for better or for worse was born with a deep anti-authoritarianism streak that I think was nurtured in me by that big, beautiful family mm-hmm. in the Northeast that I got to have. We're all, even my grandmother, my saintly grandmother, the calmest, most beautiful, wonderful human, generous, kind, loving human beings you'd ever want to know. She's my hero. She's the person I... In a perfect world, I would model my life after, and I would live as my grandmother lived. The best piece of advice she ever gave me was take your time and don't let anybody push you around. You know, and that deep anti-authoritarianism streak was, you know, fostered in this family, and when you put it in direct contact with a culture like that, that says no, this is tradition, this is how we do things. I wasn't ever going to feel right in that place. You know, I was born to conflict from the day we arrived. And that's not to say that I don't have love and admiration and respect and appreciation for a lot of the things and a lot of the people in that town.
I would bet you also gravitated toward other folks who were different in that town, who were questioners.
Oh, big time.
Who were misfits. And some of them, probably most of them, were Texans, but did not, you know, there's a lot of different ways to be a Texan. And it sounds like College Station, when you were growing up and the environment you were raised in, it sounds like was very much about hierarchy, tradition,
mm-hmm.
men do this, women do this. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't like a keep Austin weird experience of growing up.
We used to refer to Austin as Planet Austin when I was growing mm-hmm. up because it was so, and you know, that's insular in its own way too.
Oh, it sure is. It's its own, I lived in Asheville, North Carolina for a bit. And I love Asheville very, very much. It just as I love Carrboro and Durham and different places in North Carolina that are these kind of blue dots in a state that, to be fair, is fairly purple politically, but I also understood I was in these islands. And these islands, whether your island is an island of conservatism or an island of progressivism or an island of whatever we want to say, if it's an ethnic enclave or a religious enclave, it is different than what surrounds it. And it is insular in some ways.
Absolutely.
And whereas it sounds, but what you're describing is, I think, something that's common to a lot of small town life or mm-hmm. medium sized town life, which mm-hmm. is you have to act this way. As long as you behave by the code, you get to stay, because you asking questions as like a kid in church who keeps asking questions and a church doesn't encourage that, you become a threat.
Well, hello. Thank you so much, everybody, for listening to the podcast. You can support Where You From and me, Sarah Benincasa, the person who pays people to help make it via Patreon, patreon.com/Sarah Benincasa. That's patreon.com/SaraBenincasa. If you contribute $1 or more a month, there are all kinds of cool, interesting, I think fun, different things that you get out of it. Mostly you will get a lot of gratitude from me, but there will be some other things that you can get as well, including for people at a higher level, a birthday card or a signed copy of my book, Real Artists Have Day Jobs, and then some other stuff. So patreon.com/Sarah Benincasa. Regardless, thank you so much for coming along on this ride with me.
Well, of course. You're a threat to the status quo. You're a threat to the order. You're a threat to the comfort. You know, you are a threat to comfort. You are a threat to order. And I loved that. And so I, you know, part a lot of my personality from late adolescence and into my teen years and late pre-adolescence and into my teen years was set up. My personality was set up as contra. You know, I am anti whatever you got. You know, my
were you a punk kid? Were you into punk and hardcore and stuff?
Absolutely.
I figured. I
remember very, very clearly the first day that somebody walked into a room with the Operation Ivy CD and handed it to me and said, "This is going to change your world." This guy who had moved in from the Bay Area, poor guy, how he ended up in College Station from the Bay Area, I have no idea. But, you know, he handed me the CD.
He found you.
He found, well, yeah.
You guys
well,
found each other.
You know, when you fly the flag.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And everybody sort of, oh, yeah, right, okay. That, you know, he's not wearing a cowboy hat or a Garth Brooks t-shirt or a Rush is Right t-shirt. So he's probably one of mine.
Oh, yeah. You were growing up. I think we're around the same age and you were, ooh. Good Lord, that was a real time.
It was
a
time.
Up
it was a real time. And, you know, it was interesting because I was growing up with Ann Richards as the governor of Texas.
So, yes.
Like my experience of Texas is as a weirdly purple state. Mm-hmm. You know, like I remember my mom was a hardcore lefty when I was growing up. We used to get Mother Jones.
Molly Ivins is one of my great heroes.
Yeah.
My first book opens with a quote from her.
Yeah.
I mean, I have a poster with a picture of her and quotes from her on my wall. Like you grew up in that time where Texas was a lot of strong lefty ladies.
I was on the ground in Texas as an almost voting age adult when Karl Rove showed up and put that whole strategy into play, the one that eventually ran Ann Richards out of the governorship and George W. Bush took over.
It was fascinating. George W. Bush, another native of Connecticut.
Yep.
I mean, this is somebody
from
else
New Haven.
Who was born, and you probably born the same. Were you born in like Yale, New Haven?
Yale, New Haven Hospital.
You are the second Where You From guest to be Jonathan Colton, musician Jonathan Colton, grew up in Colchester. He also was born there.
Just like George W.
Exactly. You guys are all very similar.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, George W., obviously for a lot of different reasons, growing up in Texas, really went native or as native as he could.
Sure.
And you, coming from the exact same town, you probably moved to Texas maybe. You were probably, you were like five. I think mm-hmm. he was like three or something when he moved to Texas. It's because it's those extra 2 years in Connecticut that fucked you, man.
It's usually 2 years in Connecticut that fucks most people.
You would be a problematic former president today. Instead, you're a beloved actor's actor.
I will tell you, man, growing up in Texas and watching that shit happen on the ground with Rove and W and everything, when he ran for president the first time, you know, in his first campaign when he ran for president, people were sort of laughing at him.
Mm-hmm.
I said, don't you dare. You better take this guy seriously, because I watched him beat, like, throttle a beloved icon of the state of Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole state's mentality changed right after that. It was unreal. I watched it happen in real time. Bill Clinton did us no favors either in that regard. But it was unbelievable to watch. And so I've always taken that guy seriously when he started moving his way up the political ladder. And then I did the same thing when Trump showed up. I said, don't laugh at these people. Don't laugh at these people. You're going to you don't take them seriously, and you run the risk of putting them in office. And bam, I just
That's powerful.
It's really scary.
You were primed and prepped for that because you had seen it happen.
I had watched it happen.
Which is a fascinating. And so you were one of those people that probably, you know, at a certain point in the campaign, I probably was like, eh. And then as time went on, I was like, wait a second, and started listening more to people like you. Because I was like, wait a second. And I remember the night of the election in 2016, I was with a friend of mine, Ruth Ann Harnish, who's awesome. She runs the Harnish Foundation. And I was with her and her husband, who's a great guy. And we were at the New York fucking Times, of all places, watching what they did, like a whole thing with their people talking on stage about who's going to win, blah, blah, blah. And we're sitting there eating it. It's a nice catered event, you know.
Sure, watching the dial go absolutely
limousine liberals hanging out, watching this big, the returns went. And Ruth Ann, God bless her, the first, you know, from a working class family, upstate New York. I believe she had to drop out of college because she couldn't afford it. She became the first woman on-air anchor in Nashville, Tennessee, in the history of television there. And then the second one was Ms. Oprah Winfrey. and
wow.
So Ruth Ann, a real feminist, badass activist, real cool. She was like, Sarah, I think he's going to win. She said that to me like days before. She's like, I think he's going to win. And her husband and I both that night, we were both going, no, it's going to be okay. Yep. Like, he won't win. He won't win. It's fine. It'll be close. It'll be a squeaker. But she was, you know, I think having come up through the women's movement, having broken some glass ceilings herself in her day, and also having worked in different parts of the country as a journalist and in her work as an activist and beyond, she just knew, because I think she had seen in a different way, but in a similar way to what you did, she had been on the ground and seen how something can change really quickly.
And there is something to be said for the experience of living all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the 13 years that I spent in Texas has given me, I mean, it gave me a great many things, but one of the things that it gave me is the complete inability to dismiss the middle part of the country.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't ever accidentally forget them. You know, I know too many and I love too many people who live there. And I grew up there, you know, for a significant portion of my formative years. And I know from firsthand experience that their view of what it is to be a member of this republic is just as passionately held as those of us who lived in New York City or in its immediate environs that were heavily influenced by New York City, or lived in Los Angeles or San Francisco or the immediate environs that are heavily influenced by living near there. And it's real. They don't want to give up their grip on their understanding and their belief of what this country is either. They're going to fight like hell for it. And it's interesting. I mean, I don't know. Politics has always been something that is various different degrees of gradation for me. You know, it's why I don't support or rarely support individual politicians. I support ideas.
Mm-hmm.
Because I can communicate ideas with people. If I can sit down with anybody. I can sit down with the most conservative person that I grew up with. And we can have a talk about ideas. We may not agree on And 9 times out of 10, it's about the path to get somewhere is what you end up disagreeing about.
That's all. Yeah. A lot of times that is what it is.
You know, it's not even about the end game. And it certainly rarely is about how much you give a damn. You know, like if you're actually start at the same point, like, listen, OK, you love this place. I love this place. We both want what's best for it. Let's just agree with that. And then you're off and running and you can have a legitimate in good faith conversations with many people. Now, obviously, there are some people that you can't and you shouldn't, mm-hmm. you know, that there are points of view that don't deserve to be engaged, you know. And I knew some of them, too. I grew up around fucking Klansmen, mm-hmm. you know. I'm a like white kid from Connecticut, you know, and then moved to rural Texas. Like, I grew up around Klansmen. Not only in Texas, I grew up around Klansmen in fucking Connecticut.
Oh yeah, we had Klansmen over the border in. I mean, I grew up in Jersey, yep. Very close to the Pennsylvania border. But Pennsylvania, when I was growing up, had a big concentration of sure. neo-Nazis, Klansmen, who don't all identify with each other. So all right. these subtle gradations to yeah. the outside world that are very significant to folks within sure. that world. They didn't call it alt-right at the time. It was called, you know, it had different names, but it was the same kind of school of thinking yep. in general that like white is right, white is better.
Yep.
Dudes are definitely almost 100% of the time always better. White yep. dudes rock and roll always.
Yep.
And there maybe shouldn't be so much room for other humans. So that sort of ideology, I remember white power movement, that kind of thing.
Oh, yeah.
That was, you know, that was, and it was in, certainly I knew casual day-to-day racists in Jersey.
Sure.
But we have that, you know, that kind of, and kind of.
Well, that was the other thing I watched sort of happen growing up not far from Waco.
Ooh, wow.
Was that anti-governmental, anti-authoritarian, that, you know, streak that eventually led to Oklahoma City that, you know, I mean, I saw that stuff happen. I saw that happen with kids. I saw kids that I went to high school with get radicalized by what happened in Waco. No, people who couldn't have given two shits less about what the Branch Davidians believed in,
mm-hmm.
you know, but recognized that what was happening was not okay. This is fucked up. The government can't surround a building full of people just because of your religious beliefs and try to take away your kids and your constitutional rights. That's not okay. And that's how it was being painted. I don't know what the hell it was. I'm still trying to figure it all out. I know it was traumatic, you know?
I have cousins who are Polish Catholics raised in Texas. I'm the Italian side. But they're really awesome people. And I was talking to one of my cousins who recently, his goal is to take his two kids. Well, they were raised in Houston, but they live in Dallas now. And his goal with his wife is to take their two kids to all 50 states by the time they graduate.
Wow.
College, which is a
wow,
really cool goal.
Great goal.
And they went to Oklahoma, which is, you know, being from Texas is an easier get. And they went to the museum for the Oklahoma City bombing, and he was telling me about it and how, you know, I could see how moved he was. Really yeah. wonderful man. But he was talking about how powerful it was and how he learned things. I mean, you know, he learned things there. He had known about it and seen those terrifying photographs and everything. But being there and in hearing at that museum, they have a recording because there was a board meeting going yeah. on, I yeah. guess, of some sort of company that was across the way from the Murrah building,
yep.
I think. And they were recording it for notes. And you hear how they hear the big first blast and they all react and then it just keeps going. And I'm getting chills even thinking about it. I haven't heard it. But he was saying how that museum does such a magnificent job of telling a story, of making history come alive in a way that feels relevant and real. Like the way he was describing it made me think of the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum
yeah, yeah.
and then the Anne Frank House in Amsterdam.
Yep.
The way they tell this horrifying story, but through the power of storytelling and history, you feel like you're there when you're there for at least a moment.
Right.
And I mean, to have grown up where you did, when you did. And it's so fascinating to me, too, Tommy, that you said that you were like, well, I grew up in Connecticut. And then when I was 5, I moved to Texas. And I was like, wow, he really was an outsider in Texas.
Oh, yeah.
Like, even before you told me that anecdote, I was like, he from the start knew that he wasn't one of them.
Yep.
And now I know clearly it's because the teacher from the start was like, he didn't grow up here.
Yeah. He's not one of us.
Mm-hmm. You could have worked your ass off your whole childhood to try and be one of them. And some kids still would have called you out and bullied you. But like it almost could have been like, you know how sometimes when somebody converts to a religion, they become more passionate than anybody who was born into it?
Oh, yeah, there are none as passionate as newly converted.
You could have become a converted. Yeah. Converted.
Absolutely.
In that
well,
way.
Listen, you know, it's funny because I saw that happen too. You know, I had friends whose parents bought in. I don't call it selling out. I think they bought in.
Oh, it was, you were also there during the real powerful wave of the evangelical,
yep,
Christian right.
That's right.
In the 80s and in the 90s,
mm-hmm,
in a very, very powerful way. I mean, they were, yeah, remember Promise Keepers?
Yes.
Yeah.
I absolutely remember Promise Keepers. They fucked my high school experience.
And Meet You at the Pole, which was like a whole thing.
Meet me
Do
at
you
the
remember
pole?
That?
I absolutely meet me at the pole and everyone go out there and pray.
And you're,
man,
like, what?
What the fuck is going on? I had
Young Life. Oh, God.
Yeah,
I
Young
a lot
Life.
Of this shit.
I had, the Fellowship of Christian Athletes,
mm-hmm,
was really big in my high school.
For those of you teens listening, for the millennials out there, the very young ones, this was part of the, you know, movement of the religious right in the 90s. One of the very genius things that they did, that the Christian Coalition and sort of other partners did, that was really super smart, super
smart,
like a Karl Rove level genius, mm-hmm, shit, was not only to tie attendance to church and membership in church to politics. So your duty, if you are a good Christian, is to donate to candidates who don't want to murder babies, was pretty much
that's where it started.
And you don't look at, maybe you don't look at what the other candidates are thinking. So now
it doesn't matter.
No, it doesn't matter
what the other candidates are thinking.
Or
what it is black and white.
Or what your candidate, who is very anti-abortion, it doesn't matter if they also don't want to protect your watershed. It doesn't matter if they want to fuck over small family farmers.
Nope.
It doesn't matter because this is the only thing that matters. So there's this brilliant marketing strategy, really, that was deployed. But some of what they did, and this is what always is great to do, you get them young. So when, around the time when Tommy and I were in school, it was like, and I was in New Jersey, by the way. I'm talking about this shit happening in a county that's consistently red in a blue state, Hunterdon County, New Jersey. But that was all this kind of stuff, because if you make it fun and cool to be a thing, people will be the thing.
Yeah,
and it works a lot of time.
It works unbelievably well. I can't even tell you how upsetting and disturbing it was to me to be in a high school where the Fellowship of Christian Athletes was something that you were it was shocking if you weren't a part of it. People were genuinely, if you were an athlete in high school and you weren't part of the Fellowship of Christian Athletes, people looked at you like you were out of your damn mind.
So football's religion in Texas. And
football, baseball, basketball.
Yeah,
you
tie it all together with Jesus stuff. Make it real conservative.
Exactly. And, you know, all of the coaches were also teachers.
Mm-hmm.
And all of the coach teachers were also members of their church. I can't even begin to tell you how many pastors or reverends or whatever I had teaching me, coaches also teaching me various different subjects. It turned my stomach. It's part of the reason that I walked around, it's part of the reason I walked around so antagonistic towards that stuff. It's because on some level I was like, this isn't right. This isn't okay. I'm being indoctrinated. Not even all that subtly. And I'm a kid. You know, this is the time in my life when I should be asking questions and I should be demanding answers that satisfy me in order to set the course for my life. And rather than being allowed to ask those questions, I'm being spoon-fed ideology that claims that it's going to answer all of my questions for me. All I have to do is just trust it. And that to me was terrifying as a kid. Like I rebelled against that. My friend Mike, who I grew up with, always referred to me as a hardliner. He was like, you know, you could always count on Tommy to be a hardliner when it came to this stuff. I just refused to bend on any of it. And in fact, like I would bite back twice as hard as things were coming at me. because it just it something seemed off. I knew, I felt in my bones like I was, my youthfulness, my fears, my confusion, my passion, and my innocence were all being used against me. Mm-hmm. They were trying to use that stuff against me and claiming that they were doing it to help me.
They were trying to sell you something, and you knew that
gut. I knew it in my gut because I was like, this is bullshit. You can't tell me that everybody standing around the pole holding hands, bowing their head is going to make this fucking school day go better. Because right. I guarantee you that a bunch of those pricks that are standing out there holding hands with their heads bowed are getting ready to make fun of the black kid in class.
Mm-hmm.
I guarantee you that a bunch of those pricks that are standing around with their heads bowed talking about how humble and gracious they want to be are going to be making fun of the faggot.
Mm-hmm. And they're going to sexually assault somebody and act like it's okay. And
absolutely.
Some of them are going to visit their closeted rage because they can't deal with their own sexuality on others.
Absolutely.
And some are going to – I talked to a young lady this weekend who is such a cool person who was once a part of the Quiverful movement, which is like the Dugar family, right? So
yep.
There's like you have a million kids and women right. have to act this way and blah, 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 blah. And, you know, now she's a queer writer and
wow.
very much not part of that anymore. She's one of nine kids. And she was such a neat person to talk to and so interesting. And we were talking about how people who come out of movements like that, cults effectively, and I'm not necessarily calling what we saw at our listen, it was cult-like, I would certainly say. But when you come out of like a small insular environment where the rules that are set and the rituals that happen do not make logical sense in the rest of the world,
mm-hmm.
but you have to behave in these specific ways and follow these specific routines and rituals as, you know, she did. And that they come out of it with complex PTSD, that it's not all PTSD is complicated, but they come out of it with a kind of PTSD that a lot of psychiatrists and counselors and social workers really haven't been trained to address or simply haven't seen enough patients or clients to understand it because it's like coming off another planet, you know, like Planet Austin.
Yeah.
But it's like coming out of another planet.
Yep.
So when you're talking to counselors who are used to dealing with, you know, with incest, with rape, with molestation, with beatings and trauma and things like that, but without the element of religious indoctrination to it. It is different. And so I'm not saying that what we saw people a part of when we were growing up is the same as being part of a 30-person colony living in the mountains doing weird shit. But it's almost, in some ways, more bananas and probably harder to deal with because it was okay. It was culturally okay. So how fucking weird if you are the one person who says, no, I don't like this, or who loves it for a while, then sees the cracks and leaves. Like, I have friends like that.
Yeah, me too. I associated with kids like that who wanted out, you know, who sniffed the bullshit
mm-hmm.
and said, this isn't right. I want out. And what it cost them to come to that realization.
Can cost you your family.
Yeah.
And it can pervert feeling of spirituality.
I will say this, you know, and I'm going to get into trouble for this sentence. So let me just preface it by saying, hear the whole sentence, not just the beginning part.
Tommy's going to get into trouble for this sentence. Let us listen to the whole. It's like when somebody puts a video online and goes, watch till the end.
Watch till the end.
And then like the cat like hits the dog at the end.
Yeah. The one thing that cults have going for them is that there's at least a consistency of behavior.
Oh, that's comforting.
A demand of consistency of behavior, right? So if you're praying around the pole and you're a member of a cult, you more often than not have to at least adhere to the batshit crazy teachings that you're being force-fed, right? That's sort of the nature of cults. You have to adhere to the behavior. The crazy shit about the praying around the pole thing is that these people would go out there and become part of this clique that expunged them from guilt and responsibility before the day had even started, and then go out and behave however the fuck they wanted to behave. that was in direct contrast to what they had just theoretically spent the morning claiming that they were doing and who they were.
They had like checked off the box in the beginning that said, I'm going to abide by the teachings of Christ. Right. Okay, I said it in front of everybody. Now I get to go and be a bully and be a jerk and be nasty.
Right.
And it's okay.
You don't get to, you don't get to do that shit in a cult.
Yeah, and the cult, so the cult is like, I see you.
Right.
You have to do, you have to go do the weird ritual dance in the corner and talk to the robot.
Right. You're gonna pay for that.
There will be consistency here.
There will indeed.
It's, yeah, and that is why I think a lot of times, and this is a broader statement, but I think that we want as people, we want what, we gravitate to not what is right or healthy for us, but what is familiar. And if you are in, you know, if you're in a straight up cult and what's familiar to you is that you get up every day and, you know, pray to the spaghetti monster and do a backflip and then tell everybody gays are going to die and then you eat a nice meal with your family and go to sleep. Like, that's going to feel comforting. And you may not believe in the spaghetti monster. You may think gay people are pretty cool. You may actually wonder if you are gay. Like, there may be a lot of problems you have with it, but it's so comforting to have this family and to have these folks who love you and care about you.
Regardless.
Yeah, absolutely. I think an unhealthy family can be a cult of its own.
Oh, absolutely.
The rules internally inside the
absolutely.
House.
Absolutely. I mean, cults are ever present.
Yeah.
Right? Any place that demands of you your free will has tipped over into the world of cultdom. You know, your free will and your free thinking is on the line if that's what's being... If that's what's required of you to give up in order to feel comfort, start asking questions. And that for me was like a big part of growing up. I sort of felt like I could have grown up a lot happier if I would have just turned over a lot of my free thinking and free will.
Yeah, if you had bought in.
Sure.
For sure. And when it came time to look at moving away, at going to college, where did you think about going?
So
where'd you think about moving? Where'd you think about going?
I had no idea. By that point in my life, I was so confused.
Did you know you wanted to be an actor?
At that point, I had figured it out.
Okay.
I said, you know, I want to be an actor, but I wasn't sure where I wanted to go. And I had sort of been told, like, you're going to college. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
You know, that's not an option. Like, you're going to go get an education, you know, one way or the other. So it's just a matter of, like, you got to figure out where. So I remember – you remember, like, when you took your SATs, you could send the results out to, like, your, like, four schools,
mm-hmm.
you know, for free?
Yeah.
Like, if you just checked on the boxes or whatever. So I sent it to, like – Evergreen State University.
I looked at Evergreen in my mind. I didn't go, but I thought about it.
Totally.
Yeah, it sounded cool.
It sounded like Evergreen State, Emerson College in Boston.
I dropped out of Emerson. We could have gone to college
together. Oh, I know. I went to college for one semester.
Oh, very nice.
I eventually ended up going to the University of North Texas. I went.
Is that in Denton? Where
Denton.
Is that? Okay.
Yeah, they have.
I don't know how I know that.
That's incredible that you know that.
I lived for a year in Las Cruces, New Mexico, and taught high school. And I taught in a summer program outside Odessa. Neither of those places is Denton, but I must have at some
must
point.
Have been, yeah, well, Odessa's in north in the panhandle-ish, so, you know, it's.
I probably had some students who, when they were looking at colleges
were at UNT.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So you went to UNT. And
I went to UNT. For
a
semester.
Theater or what?
Radio, TV, film.
Texas has some, I gotta say, Texas has some really cool theater programs and fucking awesome theater artists. Like Texas, I love Texas. I don't live there, so obviously I don't love it enough. I don't just love it because I have cousins there. And when I was growing up, that was like a cool place to go on vacation. And that's where I ate grits for the first time, beginning a lifelong love affair.
I will tell you, man.
But, and my best friend, you know, lives there now. But Texas fucking artists are the and progressive weirdos are the fucking coolest weirdos and the best storytellers and the most fun people on the goddamn planet.
Yeah, man. Well, you know, you're creating under fire.
Yeah. And the best and you are diamonds who are emerging from
man.
It. It's really neat.
You become, you know, it teaches you real early on, you know, who your community is and you become a passionate, tattooed member of your community.
True iconoclast.
Really.
For real.
Really beautiful. And I was lucky enough to grow up around and, you know, my high school years, I got booted from my high school theater program
What did you
for being an, for being an anti-authoritarian? You know,
whatever, my man. Theater, I'm doing the Meisner technique on my own.
No, seriously, my theater teacher wanted to do Christian plays.
Oh God!
You know, that was
no, thank you.
Her primary interest was carrying the gospel of Christ through the theater department, and I was like,
you were like, let's do a Purim spiel.
Yeah, I was like, that's not half. I have no interest in that.
Let's
you know?
Do Buteau, the Dance of Darkness.
Like, it's like, no, I would like to do a high school production of the Murat Saad, please.
Thank you. Normal.
Yeah. And, you know, so I got booted out of my high school theater department for being a problem. And I ended up in the community theater in College Station, which was this made up of these extraordinary weirdos. And I just met the best people who demanded of me that I learn how to be a professional.
Wow.
Right out of the gate. And I think it's actually part of the reason why I didn't survive college. Because I walked into college having spent multiple years in the community theater in College Station, being raised by and trained by former professionals and graduates from the Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts in London.
What?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. That's amazing. You
my,
know,
the
you
guy
hadn't...
who ran oh my, my local theater company guy named Randy Wilson, may he rest in peace, he just passed away, was the original Pontius Pilate in Jesus Christ Superstar on Broadway.
What?
And he ended up in College Station, Texas, running this little community theater. And one of his right-hand people was a woman named Jo Spiller, who was one of the first American women to attend the Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts in London.
Oh, my God. So you're there with – if you hadn't gotten kicked out, if you hadn't been – you know, this obstreperous anti-authoritarian youth in that place, that you wouldn't have ended up in this program with like RADA grads and like people who are Broadway vets and who were like, yeah, you're not going to fuck around, you kid. No, you're going to come in here and you're going to work.
You're going to work.
That's amazing. That prepared you for your whole career.
Yeah. And then I went to college and they were like, and now you're going to take German. And I was like, fuck you. I don't want, I'm no interest in taking German, you know? And like, fine, biology. And I was like, no, you've lost me. You've lost me. Like, I know what I want. And so, you know, after a semester, my parents went, this is insanity. You know, you're obviously not going to class. Or if you are, you're just not present. So what are we going to do about this? You know, I came home. I threw myself back into the mercy of this amazing group of people in my local community theater. They told me I could do this for a living. They told me that I needed to get my shit together in order to do it. Because at that point, I had already developed a pretty significant drug habit. And, you know, they gave me a list of places that I needed to go. And they said, you're an artist. You go to New York and you study theater. That's who you are. And I said, really? And they said, you know, yeah, you're one of us. And I said, okay. So I looked into a bunch of theater programs in New York. God bless my poor parents. I think at that point they were scared out of their goddamn minds. You know, anything that showed any sort of like purpose and vision and direction that I had, I think that they were just thrilled.
They were relieved that you were – they were like, oh my God. Like he has
a drive. He has a focus. He has a goal. And they believed in me. And God bless them, you know, for
That's
believing
awesome.
In me. So off I went to conservatory theater program. You know, I went to Circle in the Square Theater School in New York.
You did.
I did. Oh, wow. And then I lived in New York City for longer than I've ever lived anywhere.
How long?
I guess I was in New York for just about 14, 15 years.
Was it hard for you to leave New York for Los Angeles?
Yeah.
Are you still – do you still bounce back and forth as much as you can?
Yeah. That's my home, my artistic home. You know, I don't have a hometown. You know, you were like, where are you from? And I was like, you know, we're going to talk about your hometown. And I was like, I don't have a hometown. I have parts of me that are spread out all over this country that have learned various different things in various different places. And they hold pieces of me. And have shaped pieces of me forever. And New York City is the place that is about as close to home as I've ever felt. And that's true from the first day that I landed. I landed in New York, my first day that I was there by myself. I walked out of my apartment building and I walked out onto, I was walking, I was on the corner of 52nd and Broadway because there's a rancid song about hanging on the corner of 52nd and Broadway. And so I walked down to 52nd and Broadway because it was near, it was also near my theater school, and I was just trying to get a sense of what the neighborhood was or whatever. And I was standing there on the corner of 52nd and Broadway, and a guy came up to me and said, excuse me, how do I get to such and such? And I felt immediately like I look like I belong, even though I'm utterly lost. I had no fucking clue. I gave this guy, sir, if you're out there, I apologize. I had no idea where I sent you.
He lives in New Jersey now.
Yeah. But I sent this poor guy some direction because I was incapable at that moment of saying, I don't know. But I also took it as a sign because for the first time in my life, I felt like, oh, I belong. Mm. And people recognize me as belonging. And I look so much like I belong that they're asking me directions my first hours in this place. Now, you know, that's just probably not – I was probably overstating it and romanticizing it.
No, you probably had the right vibe. You didn't look like some kid. You didn't look like a tourist. You looked like somebody who was very at home in his environment.
Yeah.
And this dude picked up on
it. And ready.
Mm-hmm.
And ready.
And you were like, well, I'll tell you. The Empire State Building is in the Bronx. And you need to go there immediately, sir.
Yeah, the poor guy was like, which way to Central Park or something? I think I just sent him east. And if he would have just looked uptown, he
would have
seen it.
Yeah, he could have gone up like 7 blocks. Like you just go across and up 7 blocks.
You can just look
fine.
Up Broadway and you can see the entrance, you know?
Like you'll get there, buddy.
Yeah, just keep walking.
Well, I would keep you for 1,000 years, but you have a life and things to do. And also maybe we could like do a follow-up sometime where we get into New York City and all the things you learned there.
Did you talk about cults with Ben Stiller?
We did talk about, oh no, but I did learn about like fun things that were happening in the Upper West Side and beyond and like adventures at that time. But we should get into, we'll get into the next, well next time I interview Ben, we'll do cults. And the next time I interview you,
we'll
do
New
York.
York
City.
Beautiful.
Tommy, thank you so much for hanging out. You
thank
are
you,
awesome.
Friend.
I want to make sure to give a shout out to War Child USA.
That
War
is
Child,
correct.
Which is an organization that does really fantastic work who with displaced folks and refugees, and who I've learned way more about thanks to you. Because you're great at talking about things that are important to you.
Yes, thank
and
you.
Where can the humans find you, you know, I don't know, on these interwebs, on a TV or in some sort of a motion picture box?
You can find me on CBS sometimes in a TV show called Life in Pieces. And then on demand, you can find The Newsroom.
Heard of it.
And you can find a bunch of movie films that I've done, like Wild. With the wonderful Reese Witherspoon, and I'm around, and I'm and then keep your eyes peeled if you live in theater going communities because I pop up there.
You consistently do. I love to do it.
I don't ever intend to.
My friend that I was talking to knew that you were Don, but was like, he's not on Life in Pieces. I was like, no, he is. He's like a main cast member. Like he's like. It's like on it. Like there's like posters and like she was like, no, that's somebody else. And I was like, who is it? And she was like, I don't know. It's not him. And I was like, I mean, your scene work in The Newsroom was so powerful that you made you a totally different person. And I was like, no, look. And she was like, all right, you're right. That is accurate.
I'm good. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. So thank you so much.
And that's it for the first season of Where You From. Thank you so, so much for coming along for the ride. If you haven't gotten to listen to all of the episodes, please go back and review. We've got some awesome, awesome guests for you to enjoy. And we'll be back next season sometime in early 2019, I hope. Fingers crossed. I'm Sarah Benincasa. Say hi to me at Sarah J. Benincasa. On Twitter and Instagram. I'm also at Where You From Pod on Twitter and Instagram. And I'm at Excellent Coats on Irritated Women on Instagram. That's Excellent Coats on Irritated Women. I mean, there's a lot of places to hang out. You can also go to patreon.com/Sarah Benincasa to contribute to my bills for this season. And also, you know, recording and stuff for next season. This has been a ton of fun. You guys are awesome. Thank you so much. Take good care.